Kowalski, Sam Nation here, reporting for duty this Friday, December 7th. Good morning. And here we are, fighting dilatory obfuscation and making dry subjects moist. Speaking of dry subjects, Bob Mueller. Now, Bob Mueller, this is a guy, you know, this is the special prosecutor who is on fuego, or en fuego, I think is the proper term. His probe into Trump-Russia collusion reaching a frenzied pitch in Washington. A lot of speculators think that this is all going to come down and drop soon. I would say the nugget, the little dribble of information that got everybody titillated this week was a memo issued by Mueller recommending no jail time for General Michael Flynn. If you remember, he was the national security advisor in the Trump administration for a hot 20-some days when Trump excused him for lying to Mike Pence, the vice president, about his contacts that Flynn had had with the Russian ambassador. Now, Flynn, apparently, generally a prosecutor, when they recommend no jail time to somebody who's pled out and who's been a cooperating witness, the reason for that is substantial cooperation. Now, here we don't have to speculate because that's exactly what Mueller wrote in his memo to the court. So before a defendant who's been convicted or has pled guilty is sentenced, there are various sentencing memos that go to the judge. Victim statements in certain cases, that type of thing. A lot of information gets sent to the court. The judge reviews it, and based on that, has final say on sentencing. So when you get the prosecutor recommending no jail time, that's a big thing. And in the filing, right, it's very heavily redacted because the filing itself has some of the juicy details. We think, we don't know, but we assume because there's a lot of blacked out text. But in the substantive part that we are able to see suggests that Flynn sat down for extensive interviews, well over 20 interviews with Bob Mueller and his team, and provided vital insight into the various contacts that the Trump transition had with Mother Russia. So, is the giddiness of our friends on the left, all these good people out there who are praying, hoping against all odds that this will be what takes down to Donaldus Maximus, are their prayers going to be answered? Well, we'll have to ask their atheist gods. But I'll tell you this. There are signs, whisperings, if you will, from the left, from the political establishment on the left, from some reasonable leftists, that this really is exactly what I've been saying along. This is nothing. These good things will end with a whimper. There was an interesting piece, and corroborate this, in Vanity Fair, which certainly is no right-wing publication, by a T.A. Frank. This The author here is a devout anti-Trumpist, and Frank writes about the skepticism that we are right to have on the Bob Mueller probe. Now, there's one. Okay, so who's being probed? Right, we got to remind ourselves, right? Because everybody looks at this as a Trump versus U.S. thing, right? The United States is finally going to be rid of this crazy guy who's in the White House. But there's all these other characters. And, Mike Flynn is one of them, right? He's the guy that got tangled in this early on. And what did he get convicted of, by the way? What did he plead guilty to? Lying. Lying about what? About meeting or not meeting the Russian ambassador and talking to him about certain things. Now, in Washington, I've said this before, in Washington, these conversations with ambassadors, like, if you're a senator, if you're in politics, if you're on a national security team anywhere, you're meeting with ambassadors from foreign countries all the time. It is a normal thing. They came in, FBI asked Flynn a bunch of questions, and Flynn lied about it. And he continued to lie about it, even lied about it to his employers. Can't do that. So he went down for that. There's other characters, right? You've heard about this Jerome Corsi guy. he's kind of a, I don't know, Republican Party gadfly, conspiracy theorist. Is he involved with InfoWars? Does he do stuff on there? WorldNet Daily. Hey, one of those, you know, kind of kooky fringe sites. So he's, by the way, Corsi, apparently he claims that Mueller's team came to him and said, hey, we want you to sign on to these versions. We think that this is what happened, X, Y, and Z. And it related to contacts that the Trump campaign supposedly had with WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, trying to get to Hillary Clinton's emails. So they said, this is what we think happened. Is this what happened? And Corsi said, no. And they said to him, well, yeah, if you don't cooperate, we're going to indict you. And here's all the things that we're going to indict you for. And Corsi again basically says, I am not signing on to their version of events, hell or high water. And they can, you know, they can lock me up for the rest of my life. I don't effing care. Basically, I'm paraphrasing, but that's how it went down. And see, this is the Corsi drama that's kind of unfolding, and it's not front page news. Not a lot of people are talking about it. Is really illustrative of how damaged potentially this whole probe is going to be, because the stronger that Mueller pushes to advance a narrative that he has preformed in his mind, Trump Russia collusion, right? Whatever narrative that is, whatever pieces substantiate that. If he's going to witnesses that are facing, you know, substantial jail time over unrelated acts or over lying to the FBI about, you know, maybe bad acts, but not necessarily illegal acts, tangential issues, and he's going to these people and he's threatening them with 20, 30, 40 years in jail. You know, how many people you think are brave enough to say no? Here's a middle finger. Here's another middle finger. These are my two middle fingers, and you can put them wherever you want. I would venture to say not many. And it damages the probe. It damages the credibility of the probe, because if all your witnesses coming forward are not voluntary, like, you know, you can impeach a witness. I'm telling you, as a lawyer, right? You impeach a witness based on their motives for telling the court, the jury, what they're telling them, right? If I've got a client and there's a narrative that a witness for the other side comes along and wants to lay out, you know, well, we think the accident happened this way. I'm going to, and it doesn't fit what I need for my case. What I'm going to do is I'm going to challenge that narrative with or that testimony with a question of credibility or reason for why the witness is saying what they're saying. And here it's so easy. Excuse me, Mr. Cohen, Michael Cohen, right? Presidential lawyer, idiot. He's, you know, pled guilty to a bunch of, you know, lying to Congress, lying to the FBI, et cetera, et cetera. Some campaign finance, financial issues, IRS issues, bunch of stuff. And Cohen gets up there and he says, this goes all the way up to Trump. Trump told me to do X. And this is somehow a very important thing to the case. And, you know, you get up there and this is what you do if you're Trump's lawyer. It's very simple. You say, look, yeah, how much jail time were you facing? Well, that was 72 years. Okay, how old are you? Okay, so that's life in prison. You are facing life in prison. How much did that factor into what you're saying today? Tell us about your conversations with the special counsel's office. Did they make you any promises of reducing that jail time if you give your testimony today? I have seen these type of trials. Now, I remember this. I was on a federal jury on a criminal case, and you know, you'd get witnesses up there, and I could watch how we on the jury sat there just, you know, agog as witnesses were admitting basically that they wanted to please the prosecutor's office, right? That's what they wanted to do. They wanted to please the prosecutor's office in order to gain an advantage. And this is exactly the problem that the probe is going to have. Tell me what willing witnesses have come forward that we know about. All we know about a bunch of people that got indicted or got threatened with indictment and pressured, right? Arm twisted into cooperation. Now, Paul Manafort's in solitary confinement, sitting there every day. You know, so can you imagine the misery of that? I mean, I don't know if that was my life right now, I would do anything to get out. And I think of myself as a, you know, fairly strong-willed person. So this is what's playing out in the scene. And this Vanity Fair piece goes through and talks about how, you know, look, I get it. I get it. We don't like Trump. But I'm a little, the author goes, I'm a little concerned that maybe, just maybe, we're going too far down, and Mueller's getting too far down a rabbit hole, caught up in how much he doesn't like all of these people, all of Trump and his cohorts, and how sleazy they are. But he's only catching them really on lies that are related to sleazy acts that people are trying to cover up. So, you know, and in particular, here's a great quote. Those, and this is from this piece in Vanity Fair, those who hope that Mueller reveals a shambolic operation with lots of rascals engaged in sleazy and embarrassing behavior will be happy with the fruits of his labors. But those who hope for an unveiling of indictments linking Putin and Trump in a grand conspiracy have no more reason to celebrate than they did a week or a month ago. And it all, and I, you know, so I'm telling you, there are even people on the left right now who are expressing great skepticism over how this all goes down. And also an ominous warning, right? Because what this has been, if they do not prove collusion, if all they do is prove that Don Jr. spoke to some Russian lawyer who promised to get him emails of Hillary Clinton where she was, right? Let's go back to what those emails said. Those emails that she deleted that contained a conspiracy of its own, right? To defraud the American voters, put her into office, perhaps, I don't know, fundraise for her campaign with foreign actors and other people through her foundation. If the conspiracy here was an attempt to get her emails for political advantage, right? And at the same time, then the other charge would be that they lied about it. If that's all this is not what the American public was sold on when this thing started. It is a big, giant womp, 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 okay? And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out and who pays for this politically. Now, then there's this ominous warning from the same piece in Vanity Fair. Quote, the weapons you create for your side today will be used by the other side against you tomorrow. Do we really want the special counsel investigation to become a staple of presidential life? It's a creation with few boundaries on scope, and a setup that encourages the selection of a suspect followed by the search for a crime. We all know it should be the other way around, right? This is a spot. This is exactly it. So what happened here is, at the end of the day, it's a political hit job. It was absolutely 100% political hit job, and it's I think it's going to end up falling apart on that. The report's going to be hugely embarrassing to Trump. There's going to be, and incidentally, I think it exposes one of his greatest shortcomings, and I still, all this time in, struggle to explain how Trump could possibly hire a guy like Michael Cohen to be his personal lawyer. I don't look from an outsider perspective. I see that as a great failing of judgment and of logic. I think anyone watching anyone listening to Cohen throughout this whole process, even in the beginning when he was still very much in Team Trump. I mean, the guy was an amateur. He's an idiot. Oh, I'm going to take a bullet for the president, Mr. Trump. You know, I'm going to take a bullet for him. Who says that? I mean, if you're representing somebody and you're, you know, representing somebody on a scale such as forget President Trump, but businessman Trump, you don't make pronouncements like this. And the same even worries me slightly with Giuliani. Some of his pronouncements lately, some of the things he's saying is just nutty. And again, that's somebody that Trump has speaking for him. For some reason, you know, Trump has this obsession with getting people who are bombastic like him, who are you know, throw caution to the wind. And what he's not realizing is that's his shtick. Trump is the guy that can throw caution to the wind. Trump is the guy who can make who can say things on Twitter, you know, and consequences be damned, you know, that type of thing. But he needs a cleanup crew of silent killers. He doesn't need to have his life preserver department, his legal team, to be in the vein of Michael Cohen or even Rudy Giuliani, who's basically a politician, hasn't been a lawyer for a long time, who are trying to be little versions of Donald Trump himself. And in the end, if there's any political price to pay, let alone a legal one, it's going to come back to these poor decisions. This has nothing to do with Trump, Russia. That's baloney. But it is interesting, and it is a lesson in life, that who you pick to be on your team, who you pick to protect you and guide you through crises, can make or break you. And that's my observation on this. We'll see how this plays out, but that's my observation here. All right, we got a lot going on today. Yeah, we're going to look more on Trump a little bit. Yes, we got PETA in the news, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. You know what? I'm going to do that next. Yeah, Sam Brzozowski, back right after this.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Sam Brzozowski, Sam Nation, PETA. The People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals organization protecting animal rights. But not really, by the way. You know, there's an article, Daily Caller, back in February of this year. What do you think of PETA, by the way? When you think of PETA, word association. I always think of PETA as the people you don't want around you when you're wearing a fur coat. I remember being in Beverly Hills years ago. My aunt was here from Switzerland. Of course, you know, I think she had some fur on. I forget that. We were all wearing leather of some sort. And it was Beverly Hills. It was on Rodeo Drive. And there was a big PETA protest outside the store. And I'm young. I don't know. Was I 10? Maybe 12? I remember being frightened. Because these people had, in their eyes, they were out for blood. Some of these people would kill humans to protect animals. I'm just telling you, that's how it is. And I also think PETA, the Daily Caller piece, okay, I was talking about that. Their kill rate in the PETA-operated shelters, I don't know if you've heard about this. They've got like a 75% kill rate. In 2016, this is what they did. They figured out in 2016, in 1 year, PETA took 2,007 animals, so 2,000 animals went into their animal protection program, right? It's like a witness protection program. I don't know. But supposedly to place these animals with families that will take care of them. Pets. Of all those 2,000 animals, 10 dogs and cats were returned to their owner successfully. And so to their original owners. And only, get this, only 57 were adopted out. So that means, what is that, 57 plus 10, 67? 67 of the 2,007 animals lived, and the rest were killed in there. And, they got into a big, you remember this legal case with the chihuahua? This little girl, little cute little girl gets a chihuahua for her birthday or for Christmas, whatever it is, loves this little dog. And the dog is unattended on a porch, and some PETA nutso, but from the organization, like a paid employee of PETA, is cruising by the house, sees the chihuahua, takes it, and they euthanize it the same day. It was a big public outcry. The case was going toward trial, and they ended up settling it for an S ton of money. What did they pay, like $60 million, $40 million? Let me look this up. $50 million. Settled it for $50 million. You know why they settled, by the way? They settled because They did not want to go to trial and have on the record testimony about their euthanasia program. I think it literally would destroy their fundraising efforts, right? All you people that think you're helping PETA. But anyway, PETA's got a new plan of how to help us be nicer to animals. When we come back, I will tell you what that is. It is a masterful ad campaign, if I must say so. Totally idiotic. And you'll laugh. I guarantee it. Sam Rejofsky back right after this.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam. Sam Rejofsky. You'll find him very anything. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Sam Rejofsky, Sam Nation, always right, rarely wrong, reporting for duty. Now, you know, there's all this policing of speech. It's the new thing, right? Things you can't say. Oh, my goodness, you cannot use the R word, right? You have to, pretty soon you don't even call somebody an idiot, right? So you've come up with all this euphemistic language for things, and really, as the older you get, and I'm only 38, but I feel like things that were totally acceptable for me to say when I was on the playground are just not acceptable anymore. And I thought naively that the older I got, I could use more words, right? On the playground, you can't say the F word. And I thought, well, you know, I'm going to get older. I'm going to be able to expand my colorful vocabulary. Wrongzo. I'm working my way backwards. So anyway, thanks to PETA, I'm going to walk even further backwards because they think that people should stop using anti-animal language. What the hell is anti-animal language? Good thing you're asking me. I will explain this all to you. From the press release, this according to ABC7, they're saying people for the ethical treatment of animals are now encouraging the public to stop using popular idioms because they are considered anti-animal language. Organizations said people should take the phrases that involve animals and make them more animal-friendly. So, they issued on Twitter, to great ridicule, thankfully. I think there's like three sensible people left in the country. They issued some guidance on phrases that should be changed. For example, when someone who is like me working hard to feed his family, if I were to say the phrase, bring home the bacon, PETA says that's no good. Because now, you know, with the bacon that comes from a pig and the pig would have to die generally. I mean, you know, unless you just shave off a little bit of the thigh and leave the pig. Anyway, but regardless, you get the point. If you bring home the bacon, a pig dies. So you can't do that. Instead, they suggest, and this is the best, they give suggestions, which is helpful. Bring home the bagels. So instead of bringing home the bacon, you're bringing home the bagels. What? Okay, all right. Well, this one's even dumber. Take the bull by the horns. Apparently, you can't do that. Taking a bull by the horns is not pro-animal. It's anti-animal. So you have to, quote, take the flower by the thorns, which is, I think, probably even more dangerous. But anyway, there it is. Oh, the horse one. This one's good. Okay, so what's the expression? When I keep ranting about Trump and I just keep saying the same thing about the Mueller investigation, I don't know. And you're saying, Sam, don't beat a dead horse. Can't do that. But you can feed a fed horse. Feed a fed horse. What Dr. Audio, what do you make of this? Oh, they didn't say there's no guidance for skin a cat. Producer Robbie, I'm going to put you on that one. Don't be the guinea pig or be a guinea pig. You know that one? The implication is that you're being tested, right? Or it's testing being done on a guinea pig. You can't do that, heaven forbid. So the answer to that is be a test tube or be the test tube. What? But my absolute favorite one, you know, when you want to be efficient, you really want to be efficient and you want to get things done. Probably, what do you want to do? Get two things done at the same time with one act? What's that phrase? Yes, kill two birds with one stone. And PETA suggests that you and I walk around like morons saying, yeah, I think I'm going to feed two birds with one scone. That's unbelievable. Right. I mean, the scone has an egg in it. So you're taking the egg from the bird. You're creating a delicious pastry out of it. But and then you're, I know, it's mystifying. But answer me this, riddle me this. Every Sunday, I wash my dogs, you know, because I'm an animal abuser. PETA doesn't believe that people should have animals as pets, foundationally. So by virtue of me keeping two caged animals, although I don't, you know, you can check with them if they feel oppressed in any way. But my dogs, you know, I bathe them every week. They do feel a certain amount of oppression when I do that. And I love that on the pet shampoo, it says product not tested on animals. And I'm like, what was it tested on? what is this? I want it to be tested on an animal before I put it on my animal. Anyway, Sam Rogowski back right after this.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Oh my gosh. And of course, we're so sensitive about everything. And this is classic. So people are responding to this prompt from PETA to be more sensitive with the language that we use. And idiomatic expressions involve animals. Can't use beat a dead horse, so forth and so on. So anyway, but the bring home the bagels instead of bring home the bacon. Somebody wrote on Twitter, could you be more insensitive to the plight of the homeless, not to mention those with non-celiac gluten intolerance? Now, you know what? I looked at this. This guy's kidding, okay? He's kidding. It's a joke. The fact that we're laughing at it because somebody out there is going to be offended by you equating providing for your family with stuffing your face full of bagels that, you know, that they can't eat because of certain intolerances, allergies, etc. You know, stepping back from all the minutiae, right, of the political landscape. It's a political show, current events-driven program here on Sam Nation. So sometimes we get a little bit into the weeds. But let's step back from it a minute and understand that it doesn't matter a hill of beans what Bob Mueller is doing with the Russia probe. Trump has foundational, ground floor, granular appeal to the American public because he mocks this type of insanity. We always learn, whether it's in business with cycles or trends, right? Fashion. Things are cyclical. There's a pendulum. We talk about a swinging pendulum. And a cycle, what happens with a cycle? By definition, it's circular, right? It goes around and it comes back. A pendulum swings out and then back in. This stuff is so ridiculous, and I think we're reaching a saturation point. We're getting to a point where people, and it's transcending political boundaries. So you get a guy like Trump, right, who's really at the end of the day, he's not an ideologue. He's a pragmatic deal maker. It's something we're lost in because everybody's in the media certainly has vilified him and paints him with a pitchfork and a bifurcated tail. Cloven hoof, and so forth and so on. But you get away from the fact you've got actually a guy that, as far as past presidents, relative to past presidents, is non-ideological and actually not very partisan. But what he is doing is he has captured almost perfectly to the T a cultural revolution that is, I think, it's going to peak if it hasn't peaked already. I'm just speaking from my personal experience here. I'm born in 1980. I was born into a world of unprecedented stability and prosperity. Now, I know, there are flashpoints throughout the world, places that are poor, places that are stricken with either conflict or famine or disease. I understand that. But overall, when you compare the world that I grew up in to the world that my grandparents grew up in, there's no comparison. There's just no comparison. And I look at, I always say with people, if you don't have problems, you invent them. And this is gospel truth in life, in business, in politics. And so in this period of prosperity, in this period, and it took a long time, we fought against slavery. We fought the bloody, this country nearly bled itself to death, fighting to abolish slavery. We prevailed. The civil rights movement fought to restore rights and give equality to all men and women. And we're getting further and further down the line, and now we're quibbling about words and quibbling about this 100 genders on this list, this person with number 32, the 32nd gender on the list, that person, we really need to be compassionate. Are we splitting the hairs a bit fine? Where do you think most people are? I mean, maybe, just maybe, we here in Orange County, in L.A. County, in West Hollywood, in Santa Monica, in Newport Beach, Laguna Beach, I think we're a little too close to all of this insanity. And what's happening is we forget that there's a whole lot of people out there who hear this kind of nonsense, laugh at it, but want to turn the tide. So this is something that is happening. I feel it. I sense it. And the evidence, great evidence of it, are a number of old school liberals, leftists, like Camille Paglia and others, who have had enough of it too. And find that this type of regulation of speech, regulation of conduct, is not only illiberal and contrary to everything that they, as liberals, fought for many, many years ago, but also profoundly un-American. All right, don't go anywhere. Back right after this.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Murjowski. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
Sam Murjowski, Sam Nation. I'm going to go to the sound bites here, because we've got some little bit of misunderstanding. Speaking of the R word that we cannot say on the program, also known as idiot, Senator Mazie Hirono, whenever the people out there think that the Republican Party is lost, I tell them, okay, maybe a little bit, but we've captured for the first time, Republicans, and not all Republicans, but Trump, as the de facto leader of the Republican Party, has captured important, core, visceral, cultural issues. The war against political correctness being one of them. So you know it's bad when the Democrats themselves, as articulated here on Tuesday at a conference attended by Senator Mazie Hirono says this about Democrats having a difficulty reaching out and connecting with voters right now.
One of the things that we Democrats have a really hard time is connecting to people's hearts instead of here. And I have been saying at all of our Senate Democratic retreats that we need to speak to the heart, not in a manipulative way, not in a way that brings forth everybody's fears and resentments, but truly to speak to the heart so that people know that we're actually on their side. We have a really hard time doing that. And one of the reasons that it was told to me at one of our retreats was that we Democrats know so much. That is true. And we have to kind of tell everybody how smart we are. And so we have a tendency to be very left brain. That is not how people make decisions.
What? Maisie Hirono says that we need to speak to the heart, not in a manipulative way. We have a hard time doing that. We're so smart. We Democrats are so smart. We have a tendency to be left brain. So, the Democratic Party, under Bill Clinton, under Barack Obama, you're telling me that they were doing a bunch of, right, look, the whole thing was right brain. The whole thing was heart. What do you feel? Your feelings, your everything. Bill Clinton literally said, right, I feel your pain. It's a terrible Bill Clinton accent, but that's literally what he said. But they aren't missing the boat because they're too smart for their own good. They're missing the boat because they're too dumb to understand what the issues are. They are stuck in their bubble, in their echo chamber, absolutely convinced that despising Trump is the number one issue. And what will end up happening to them is, look, this little blue ripple, whatever it was, fine. But as the economy improves, as things get steady, as the trade deal with China shakes out, because remember, all these setbacks right now are a function of sorting all these things out. It'll settle. And when it does, you're going to be holding a bag of a whole lot of nothing. And not seeing that is just so I hope they don't listen to the show because I don't want them to understand it and get it. Sam Rogowski, we have an hour of the program already in the can. Don't go anywhere because one more hour straight up next.
We shall fight on the airwaves. We shall fight on Twitter and Facebook. We shall broadcast our program, whatever the cost may be. And if Sam Nation lasts for 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour.
Hi, Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, back for a second hour of hot sniggity goodness. Look, I'll tell you. This, all of this background on political correctness and how people are reacting to it and relating to it also plays into the entire narrative of what it means, right, to have political traction in this country. What do I mean by this? The Democrats have absolutely been convinced that the very tread of their tires of political traction, right? The very essence of what it means to have a grip on the political system, on the hearts and minds of the voting public, is identity politics. It's a cornerstone of the Democratic Party agenda. And I've always been fascinated by this because, I'm this person, and I think like many people out there, I really don't care if you're a man or a woman. I don't care if you're black, if you're white, if you're Asian. Doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is the substance, the core substance of your character. What matters to me is your competence, your fit for a particular position or job. I believe in meritocracy, and actually realize I think that much of the world, and old Europe certainly, fell apart in moments and times when a meritocracy was abandoned, when people received positions based, for example, on connections, family, and birth. So in fighting for true equality, the Democratic Party used to have the advantage at one point during the civil rights era that they wanted equality. But the equality conversation, if you will, or the equality argument shifted into identity politics promotion. And this, I think, is ultimately what, well, it's not all, it's one of the things that really is driving people nuts and driving people to want some profound change in our system. So here, there's an interesting back and forth. Real Clear Politics associate editor, A.B. Stoddard, is trying to figure out and get to the essence of what is wrong with the GOP right now. And there's a lot of hand-wringing about this, a lot of internal hand-wringing, right? You've got, certainly, you've got people like John Kasich, okay, outgoing Ohio governor, who just thinks the Republican Party is off the rails, that Trump has hijacked it and we're further from what the Republican Party should ever have been. And then you've got people on the, you know, on the outside who are looking in and going, look, the Republican Party is more racist than ever. And you're going to hear this over and over again. It's part of a, I think, deliberate pitch to recast or retell the story of where the party's headed. So in order to understand, this is a comment. It was a little throwaway comment, but an interesting one. That is trying to get at what's going on with the Republican Party. Listen to this very closely.
What these Republicans are talking about privately is a new delineation, a realignment that makes them the party of white men. The new conference is much more Trumpian and silent on this question. So they can't have a debate about a course correction, even though they know that this is where the party's headed. It's an amazing moment. It's like alcoholic children. You just laugh of an alcoholic parent. You keep laughing and you hide in your bedroom when it gets really bad. They will not address this. Their leadership refuses to, and they're afraid of Trump.
I don't think this is true one bit. And I'll listen to me why. So first of all, the Republican Party isn't more white than ever. And I don't know, there's a big difference between voting against identity politics, voting for the best candidate, and voting for the white candidate. I mean, and there have been a number of studies, by the way, done on this. You know, how many people actually are voting for the white candidate? You know, we follow and have talked about the race in Utah, for example, where a white Democrat in Utah 4th, Ben McAdams, won over a black Republican, female, okay, Republican. Why did he win? He was a better candidate. He was. These things happen. But extrapolating from that race, for example, and others actually similar to it, extrapolating from that, that the Democratic Party is somehow now a party of white men is equally absurd. The effort underway right now, number one, is to explain the Trump phenomenon. First things first, the media still doesn't get it. The Democrats, they still don't get it. They want to pin it on Trump Russia. Some of them are true believers on this subject, right? They want to create there's a myth out there that they have to believe because they can't believe that they lost on the substance of their candidate and on their ideas. So that's one thing. But the other thing is this effort to cheaply divide us, right? And to stoke the fears that there's this bigoted, you know, white supremacy movement afoot in Trump's Republican Party. Nothing is further from the truth. I've known countless people who've worked with him, who've known him, the idea of Trump as a racist, the idea of the most absurd one, right, of Trump being somehow anti-Semitical. He's his daughter's Jewish, right? He loves Israel. He's done more for Israel than any of the last five presidents. None. Zero. Zip. Better than Reagan. Better than Bush, better than George W. Bush. So look, this is the idea. These things that are being put out there are strictly efforts to separate, to get, to incite people, right? To just to think like this that the Republicans are all nutty. But I also think, and this is interesting, I think that the problem is that a lot of Republicans buy into this. There's a lot of Republicans out there that think that one of their core purposes is diversity. They buy into the premise of the criticism. Do you remember Mitt Romney during the campaign when he was running against Obama? And Obama, this is the binders full of women moment. Remember the binders full of women, and he ended up getting mocked because, ha, 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 rich white guy has binders full of women. And it was really unfortunate, a kind of an unfortunate misspeak that got blown out of proportion. But that really wasn't the problem for me. The problem for me and the reason why Mitt Romney lost, this is critical, the reason Mitt Romney lost is he would buy into the premise of the criticisms that were leveled against him. How did that binders full of women remark? What was the genesis of it? The conversation, I just remember the words exactly, but was, we believe Obama goes, we've got a diversity. What are you going to do? And who was the gal who was doing that? Candace Crowley. I think the question is, what are you going to do for diversity? Because you're a white guy. You're just a white guy. And what are you going to do for diversity? And Obama chimes in and Trump says, well, listen, Romney says, look, we've got a lot of really qualified women. We got binders full of women that we're considering for top posts in the administration. You know what the answer was to that? What kind of a ridiculous question are you asking me, you idiot? I'm going to hire the best people for the job to do the best job for the American public. The American public is diverse. The American public, we are who we are. Each of us, regardless of our gender, regardless of our race, regardless of our sexual orientation, deserve the best possible government. Who I put in positions, what they look like, who they, what gender they choose to sleep with, is irrelevant to providing the best possible government for our people. You ought to be ashamed of yourself for asking that question. That should have been the answer. But the Republicans that are buying into this idea that Trump, by shooting down these types of ridiculous posits, by not he won the campaign because he didn't accept the premise of the criticisms that were leveled against him. He didn't answer every criticism. He wholesale shot down the constructs that held up the criticisms. Bingo. Yes, that's what you do. And the Republican Party is only lost to the extent that members within it don't get this. Identity politics, separating people out into little categories. Okay, you're Native American and you're Latino and you're they want us all divided and tabulated into separate little columns and identified. And then we are all sold on the myth that by virtue of our separation, our unique identity are somehow disadvantaged by the system. And who is the savior, right? Who is the savior then of poor little me, Czech immigrant, second generation Czech immigrant, poor little Sam. But who's going to come to Sam's rescue? Aha, the government. We're going to, we're the answer, of course. But it has profound economic, not just social implications, right? Because when you feed people a myth of victimhood, it decreases productivity. If you go into the office, do you manage a team? If you manage a team in your company, for example, and you go to that team and you say to them, I just feel so bad for you. I don't even understand how you can do your job so well. You've got so many things working against. You've got three kids at home. You keep repeating that to people. Do you know what will happen? They will stop working as hard. Guaranteed. If I'm working somewhere and I'm working really hard because I want to get ahead and I want to promote up, And my boss comes over and says, "My gosh, you're working so hard. I don't even get it. How can you work so hard? You know, you've got three kids at home. Don't you need to leave a little early? Don't you feel that that's a negative the drain in your life? You must be so tired." And pretty soon I'd be like, "Oh yeah, okay. Well, that means I can slack off a little bit." The same is true, not just in a micro context, but in a macro context, right? You keep telling this to people, and many of them will buy into it. And I tell you, I, and again, a country's, you know, this comes down to economics, right? A country's GDP requires individual productivity rates to be high, requires more, far more producers than takers. And in that equation, the Democratic Party will lose, because the Democratic Party, after they've divided all of us, after they've told us what big victims we are and how evil this new Republican Party under Trump is, those white men taking over, racist, then they tell us how it's affecting us. And after that, they tell us that they need, that we all need their help. But next thing you know, right, there are more services, there are more costs, there are more outflows of expenditures on decreased productivity. And this is a simple economic equation. As soon as labor productivity goes down, as soon as output per individual decreases, and you have expenditures rising, government expenditures, which you don't print money. You can, but Venezuela tried it, not working really great. So what do? You start to run out of money. And this, I think this is still, for now, something that most of the American public viscerally, on some level, doesn't like. And the media is missing this. It's just missing it. You raise a great point, producer Robbie. The Condi Rice, when she said soft bigotry of low expectations, would be the example she meant in her own experiences as a black woman, is people expecting less of her, and implying victimhood, right? And explaining any shortcomings that she might have. So my approach generally to people, and when I as a manager, is I expect everybody to perform at their best. And I tend to define somebody's best based on their skill set, my perception of their skill set. But also, I define their best as something above what they're doing. Because I always want you, if you're working with me, I want all of us to get better. You know, year over year, I want there to be improvements. And so imagine expecting less than what somebody is able to produce instead of more. It's really it has a devastating impact. It has a devastating impact on greater society. And my fear is that the Democratic Party really, and this is the last 40 years, the Democratic Party have made it all about victimhood, all about how bad and how racist and how horrible America is. When in reality, we keep increasing and bettering ourselves, but we only better ourselves not through government, but through hard work, independence, strength, courage, and even family, a family unit. So this is what I think is happening. People are sensing it. And so in that sense, the political correctness language, it's only a fragment of this. It's part of the broader cultural picture of some type of revolt happening in America. All right, Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation Radio, back after this.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam Rogowski. You'll find him very anything. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation. So last week I mentioned I'd been to Barbados over the break, Thanksgiving break. And one of the things, as kind of a companion to what I was just talking about, was an incredible amount of people at this resort that we stay at every year surprised me as being positive about Trump. So it, by virtue of it being Thanksgiving break, even though this is a resort that is favored largely among Brits and some other miscellaneous Europeans, there are a lot of Americans that come down during the same time period. And in many cases, there are people that are there year over year, so you kind of get to know them. And you may all be shocked by this, but when I'm on vacation, I don't like to talk about politics. First of all, I want to have a good time, and I don't need some virulent anti-Trumpist wanting to run me off the beach. You know, I don't need that. So I want to relax and keep everything copacetic. So I don't really bring this up, but it was interesting to me. And again, this is not big data. This is just impressions and indicators, but of an interesting cross section of people, because the people that are there are far more accomplished than me. I mean, these are people who are movers and shakers in society. They are. I'm not going to mention names, but they're big CEOs but traditionally, I will say this, by virtue of their position and their backgrounds, I would guess they would be Democrats. And in fact, I will say what I'm finding from not just that trip but other encounters is that a large number of older Democrats, of old school liberals, people who came of age in the 1960s and were very much influenced by the anti-war movement, Vietnam, anti-establishment, wanted to, flower child movement, right? Hippie movement. These people now, as they have matured and become older, are so repulsed by what the Democratic Party has become, and are so upset over some of this ridiculous nonsense with you know, racism and political correctness and open borders, another one, that they are quietly, subtly becoming pro-Trump people. And I think they were, I got approached a few times, so maybe they were, I think in a couple of cases, people looked me up and kind of got a read on where my politics are. So I would get approached. People knew that I was a safe space, right? But for example, there's one family I was talking to, and they're from New York, also live in Palm Beach. They're generational Democrats. And one thing that this wonderful lady told me is, look, my parents came to this country. They were escaping Adolf Hitler. And they had to wait in line. And talking about the caravan right now, it's still an ongoing issue. Bunch of people amassing at the border. I was watching the news this morning and this tear-jerking, it's a local news, whatever it was, ABC7, tear-jerking story about a Guatemalan family that, you know, came to the border and were separated. That narrative, I am telling you, is falling on deaf ears with many, many traditional Democrats. And I actually know that now that we have our incoming Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, seeking to build bridges with the more moderate Democrats, because a lot of emphasis is placed on this incoming class of freshman Republicans. They're white. They're pro-Trump. They're diehards. But we're also forgetting that there are a number of Democrats that got elected in this blue wave that ran in conservative districts, were good candidates. I'll tell you, Harley Ruda here, wasn't he a Republican like 10 minutes ago? I think he was a registered Republican at one point. These are not Ocasio-Cortez and Kamala Harris. That's only one group of Democrat. In this latest wave, you have people who are quite conservative, actually, for Democrats. And you're starting to hear on the immigration issue, the one issue that the Democratic Party and the media thinks they're going to sink Trump on because he's such a heartless racist, because he doesn't want, you know, brown people in this country. They literally say things like this. We've played the clips. You will now hear some softening on this issue. So we'll take a break. I will get to this Nancy Pelosi clip because I think this is, it's interesting. Changes in the air, and it not everything is what it seems, or certainly not what you hear on CNN or MSNBC. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation Radio, back after this.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
The immigration issue is far bigger, even to Democrats, than I think anybody in the media really recognizes. And I've been, you know, over the period of months and years here, I've been saying something to the effect of everybody understands what a line is. That orderly society, a civil society, understands that there is a queue. That's what the British call it, a queue, a line, first come, first serve. There's something very democratic about that, and we respect it. When somebody comes, wants to cut in line, we don't like that. And I think that's part of this. And I was just mentioning somebody I'd met on vacation, an older lady who, you know, mother, father, parents, grandparents, all Democrats, you know, on her husband's side, all Democrats. And they are slowly coming around to Trump by their own admission. And one of the key reasons is she's saying, look, my parents were escaping Adolf Hitler coming from Germany during the war, and we had to wait in line. There was a process. There were steps to be taken. There were laws to be followed. The idea of just opening the border and wholesale, you know, accepting 2,000, 3,000 people that just decided to form a caravan is nuts. And it offends a lot of people that are traditionally Democratic. Now, you may think I'm crazy, but I am hearing things even from Nancy Pelosi that suggest that some softening on this issue may be happening. Here on Thursday, Nancy Pelosi said this.
Some of the House Democrats are concerned about adding more money for this border fence. And if you guys do a CR, my understanding is that that would approve $1.3 billion for the border fence, correct?
And no, not necessarily.
Because that's what it was last year. So if you just extend that again, wouldn't that cause a problem?
No, I mean, it depends on how you spend the money. It's border security. It's about border security.
But within that, there was money for the fence as well.
Well, you're talking about a fence. You're not talking about a wall now.
Oh, Nancy Pelosi is willing to pay for a fence. You know, look, I get the sense if Trump can push a needle from no border protection on the Democrats to at least getting some, you know, some electrified fence or whatever it is. No, it's not what I wanted, right? And I'm not going to sit here like Ann Coulter and say it's a wall or nothing. He's got Democrats in Congress. He's got nincompoop Republicans in Congress. What are you supposed to do? The way you negotiate with somebody is they're at zero, you're at 100. Get them to 50. It's a win. You've just gotten half of what you want. So all of you, I respect you, right? If you were diehard Trumpists, you give the guy a break. He just got Nancy Pelosi to accept the fact that some money may in this, you know, continuing resolution. That's what CR is, continuing resolution. So they sort of pass the buck along and continue spending on an issue before they completely resolve it. So they're going to spend some money on a fence. Well, we're not talking about a wall. She gets all defensive. It's a tell. And it's happening in part because her own caucus is going to be pushing for this. One little news item that came out this week, a letter sent to the Democratic Party leadership from the incoming freshman class of congressmen, Democratic congressmen, have told them, we don't want you focusing on Trump and the Trump investigations. We want to talk about policy. We want to solve issues such as housing. We want to solve issues such as homelessness. We want to solve economic opportunity issues. We want to get into policy, and we don't want to get bogged down fighting Trump. Bingo. These guys get it. Now, why are they sending her that letter? They're sending it to her because they ran in their districts that were, in many cases, heavily Republican or conservative or 50-50 close. They ran in these districts and they won because they promised not to, you know, to get too partisan. They promised to stand up to Nancy Pelosi. They promised not to even support Nancy Pelosi. And frankly, it's still very much up in the air whether or not Nancy Pelosi will become Speaker of the House. Because when the full House votes for their leader and there are enough Democratic defectors, she may not have enough votes. Now, they've got enough of a majority to where I think it would have to be something well over 40 congressmen that would not vote for her. But it'd be a big problem if you ran in a conservative district and it's, you know, 2-1 Republican. Like many districts, for example, Huntington Beach here, Dana Rohrabacher's district, if Ruta ran on not supporting Pelosi, if he ends up supporting Pelosi, he's got a problem. So this is something to watch. But got to give Trump his due. And he's moving the needle on this and actually may end up getting more done with Democrats than those nincompoop, wishy-washy Paul Ryan Republicans. All right, back right after this.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation, with 2018 election in the bag and figured out and sorted, and I think the recounts are all wrapping up. We've lost an election to talk about, so we're moving on. We're moving right ahead to 2020. This is normal. This happens every year. I would say, generally speaking, there would be no speculation about whether or not the incumbent is going to be the nominee. I think what depends on Trump being the nominee really just depends on Trump. There will be no challenge of substance to his path to renomination. So I think, you know, to dismiss all thought, I guess if there's some small chance that Trump says, I'm not running. And you heard Roger Stone last week mention something about that. Said, you know, my sources tell me Trump is not going to run for re-election. I think that if Trump thinks he's going to get real, he's going to run. He's not going to give this up. It's not in his nature. But at any rate, the real race is on the Democratic side, and they are convinced, right? Same way, by the way, that Republicans were convinced that Obama was an absolutely failed, you know, horrible, going down in flames candidate in 2012. He had done so many stupid things. His approval rating was in the toilet. You know, he was aloof. He wasn't delivering on the promises. He shoved health care for all down our throats. It was not popular. In 2012, Barack Obama, extremely vulnerable as a candidate. So flash forward a few years. We now have Trump in a similar predicament, albeit with this giant Mueller probe hanging over his head, which I suspect, if it wraps up anytime soon, will become old and fleeting news by the time 2020 comes around. The action on the Democratic side, though, is worrying for the Democrats. So do you have any idea who's running? Do you know this? Every morning I wake up and there's another pronouncement from somebody who's going to run. I hear Michael Bloomberg is going to run. I hear that Joe Biden is going to run. I hear that, certainly Bernie Sanders is back in. It goes on and on. So here is House Representative David Cicilline. Is that how we pronounce that? Cicilline, a Democrat, Rhode Island, talking about how many candidates there are, speaking to Haley Jackson on MSNBC. Listen to this exchange.
We'll have 30 or 40 probably great candidates running for president,
I
think, because everyone recognizes how urgent this moment is in our history of our country. And we need a great nominee. And I have every confidence that we're going to have a terrific nominee and we're going to beat the Republican nominee in 2020.
40? Really? 40 candidates?
Yeah. I mean, You know, there's a lot of U.S. senators who are talking about, a lot of governors, a lot of people outside of politics. I think we're going to have a big field of great candidates that are going to give us an opportunity to sort of test their mettle during the primaries. And, you know, Senator Warren's great. Vice President Biden's terrific. Sherrod Brown is terrific. John Hickenlooper
of Colorado.
I think there are a lot of great candidates.
Ah, well, listen. His judgment aside on who he thinks are great candidates, right? Because Elizabeth Warren is terrible, for starters. But look, the idea that there could be up to 40 candidates, even if it's 20 candidates, 30 candidates, do you understand how disastrous is? You remember, right, when Hillary was running, there were three people in the race. Her, Bernie Sanders, and a guy nobody cares about. And those three people, I mean, you know, the guy dropped out, and then it was her and Bernie fight, you know, mano-a-mano fight to the death. It really wasn't a fair fight because the whole thing was rigged from the beginning. Number one, the fact that there are so many candidates tells me everything I need to know about Hillary Clinton being done. Right? You know Hillary Clinton is done because there's no front runner status, right, that she had going in, like she had going into 2016. But the other thing is, more is not merrier in these situations. Less is more. Literally. Because 40 candidates, what I'm picturing is like a sorority pillow fight. Picturing feathers everywhere, a giant mess in the room. They're all going to go after each other. And in that process, actually, great candidates don't shine. Remember how tough it was in the beginning for Trump? Right? In the beginning, Trump wasn't getting any traction. He was starting at 1%, 2%. And one of the reasons for that is when they held a debate, for Iowa voters to decide who were they going to caucus for and da-da-da, You could only give so much airtime to each candidate because you had 17 bozos up there on stage. What are you going to do with 40? You're going to have 40 people. With our attention spans, who's going to watch a 10-hour debate? Nobody. So they're each going to get like 2 seconds to speak. And unless there's somebody out there who's a media genius in the same way that Trump is, forget about it. They're never going to get anywhere. This, all of you who think that Trump's going to be done for and is not going to get reelected, I have bad news for you. It ain't looking good for you. It's looking a lot better for him. I'm going to close with a little bit of Meghan Markle up next. Just, indulge me, a little TMZ gossip a la Sam Nation. Back after this.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem, and Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Sam Rzhovsky, Sam Nation. I remember during the wedding or around the time of the Meghan Markle wedding to Prince Harry, I remember reading a piece in the Daily Mail by Piers Morgan. You know, Piers, he's the he used to be on CNN, right? He was on CNN. And then now he's a Good Morning Britain, which is kind of like Good Morning America. When I was in Switzerland last month, 2 months ago, whenever it was, I happened in my hotel room to have that channel. And I watched him. By the way, I got to tell you, great. I wish we got that channel here. I wouldn't want, Good Morning America, I think, is dog crap. But Good Morning Britain, he's funny. I disagree with him on a lot of issues, agree with him on others. But he's wildly entertaining and an interesting person. He's an interesting, smart guy, my opinion. So at any rate, I remember around the time of the Meghan Markle wedding, him writing this piece that was just, this is, Meghan is exactly what the monarchy needs and da-da-da. And again, this is how liberals think. I think he's a liberal guy overall. What do they like about Meghan Markle? I'll be honest with you. They like that she's an outsider. They like that she's black. They like that she's, out, a some breath of fresh air to the stodgy institution, because a lot of Brits want to de-stodgify the monarchy. When I happen to think, this is my opinion, I happen to think that the monarchy is just fine being stodgy because it reminds us about what it means to be British. Stiff upper lip, you know? You don't cry, you don't wear your feelings on your shoulder, you don't... You are the backbone of the country. And there's something very stabilizing and conservative, inherently conservative, about having a traditional functioning monarchy like that that carries forth the old traditions of the country. So I generally just dismiss this type of argument out of hand. But I also looked at this, and I'm looking at it strictly from a relationship perspective. Okay, I'm married. I know what it's like to get along with in-laws. I thankfully have really good in-laws. And I also know that I wouldn't have married my wife if her family was a mess. I just wouldn't have done it. Now, this may be a very unpopular position to take, but I wouldn't have done it. Because if you're engaged right now, and the person you're engaged to has nutty parents, and they're divorced, and they're fighting, and they're dead. I'm telling you right now, that is going to become part of your life. You're going to acquire that problem on an ongoing, renewing basis forever. If you have children with your spouse, even a divorce won't cure you of having to deal with these type of complications. And so I'm looking at Harry and I go, look, I understand your parents had some issues and problems, but you come from a stable family unit, okay? And you have no idea what you're marrying into. This over here, the guy, the dad in Mexico, the mom who's a yoga teacher in L.A., the stepsisters that's, you know, rolling around, showing up at the palace gates with letters and misses. This is crazy. So I read Pierce's comment, and Pierce was, oh, this is the best thing for the monarchy. And I just felt a groan in my stomach, because I just think this gal is trouble from start to finish. So news has leaked out over the past few weeks about Meghan Markle being a bridezilla during the wedding, yelling at staff. There's a rift, apparently, between, I know, just hear me out. It's not a gossip column. There's a bigger point I want to make. But that there's supposedly a rift between her and Prince William's wife, Kate, right? And they had to move out from the building where they all, you know, or have apartments, and they moved over across town to Windsor Castle and da-da-da-da-da. Suddenly an article comes out, Piers Morgan, titled, Meghan Markle is a ruthless social climbing actress who has landed the role of her life and is determined to milk it for all she can. And that's why the palace is beginning to turn on her. And it goes through. And now suddenly he's talking about, Pierce is finally talking about how his own experience of getting used by Meghan Markle and how two-faced she can be. And it's just interesting. It's a media observation here, folks. That's what this is. It's a media observation. The media, when they present the news, even somebody who is so intelligent, in my view, intelligent and captivating and charming. And even I liked watching his show, right? A guy like Piers Morgan, who's presenting news, it's always ideas and thoughts are always framed in compartmentalized segments. They never link a whole history together. So during the wedding, what was popular to talk about? Oh, this is so great. This is so wonderful. It's so great. And the reason that he's talking about it in that moment is because that was conventional wisdom. To get out there and say something wildly unpopular like, this woman's a cow and Prince Henry's probably going to end up regretting this, and this may end up becoming a giant, you know, black eye. I mean that just black eye, okay? On the face of the monarchy. You know, that would be, you know, you can't say that. You can't say that. So it was all nice, 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 nice. And then now bad news is leaking out. Why? Why is it leaking out? Because my theory is that the staff is so fed up with her that they are leaking to the media. This is their cry for help. So it's probably even worse than what's being reported. And And now he feels liberated to tell, you know, his whole backstory of how poorly she treated him. Opportunism. But in so doing, robbing you and I, right, of the real story at the time that it happens. So that's one thing we don't do here on the program, even if it's wildly unpopular. If it's the truth, I'm going to tell you. All right. Let's have a great weekend. It's Friday. I hope we all have fun plans. Stay dry. I know the rains came down hard, and we're drying off today. I know we are. Stay safe. Sam Rogowski, over and out. People.